Part 1. The Hidden History of the Third Reich. Chapter 1. A New Reich Begins. Hitler's Support Group. Following the armistice of 1918, which ended World War I, German soldiers returned home to a country economically devastated by war. The Bavarian city of Munich was hit particularly hard, with jobless ex-soldiers wandering the streets and a number of splinter political parties vying for membership. It was in this setting that Hitler, a 29-year-old veteran, came into contact with members of the Thule Gesellschaft, or Thule Society, ostensibly an innocent reading group dedicated to the study and promotion of older German literature. But the society, composed mostly of wealthy conservatives, ardent nationalists, and anti-Semites, actually delved into radical politics, race mysticism, and the occult under its emblem, a swastika superimposed over a sword. The society also served as a front for the even more secretive Germanenorden, or German Order, a reincarnation of the old Teutonic Knights, which had branches throughout Germany patterned after Masonic lodges. It is believed that these lodges carried on the agenda of the outlawed Bavarian Illuminati, with its fundamental maxim that the end justifies the means. In other words, members should pretend to be anything or anybody, adopt any philosophy, tell any lie, steal, cheat, even kill, as long as it accomplishes the society's objectives. Members of the Thule Society encouraged a Munich locksmith and toolmaker named Anton Drexler to bring workers into the political process. The unassuming Drexler founded the Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, or German Workers' Party, which was guided to prominence by covert aid from conservative elements within industry and the military. Hitler, unable to make a living as an artist, turned to earning money by serving as an army intelligence agent, reporting to Captain Karl Mayer. One day I received orders from my headquarters to find out what was behind an apparently political society which, under the name of German Workers' Party, intended to hold a meeting. I was to go there and look at the society and to report on it, Hitler recalled in Mein Kampf. Arriving at the Sternecker Brau beer house, he was not overly impressed. I met there about 20 to 25 people, chiefly from among the lower walks of life, wrote Hitler. However, the young military agent stood and astonished the small gathering by arguing against a proposal that Bavaria break ties with Prussia. Impressed with the nationalistic and anti-Semitic views of the fledgling party, military authorities allowed Hitler to join and began funding the party's work. He became the party's 7th registered member. Hitler's work in the party was initially supported both by funds from Captain Mayer's Army Intelligence Unit and the dedicated anti-communists and occultists of the Thule Society. Funding was passed through the publisher of occult literature, Dietrich Eckhart, whom Hitler called the spiritual founder of National Socialism. Eckhart was soon introducing the new member to the right social circles in Munich and his intellectual friends in the Thule Society. Editors of Time Life Books noted, Dietrich Eckhart took over as editor of the Völkischer Beobachter and renamed Münchner Beobachter, which the party had purchased from the Thule Society with money supplied partly by Mayer's secret army account. Author Joseph P. Farrell stated that the covert connections of Eckhart and future Deputy Führer Martin Bormann supported the idea that Hitler was deliberately manipulated and placed into power, and secretly manipulated behind the scenes by more powerful forces than even he wielded, and, when he had served his purpose, was deliberately sabotaged and cast aside. The forceful Hitler, armed with adequate funds, quickly gained control of the German Workers' Party, which soon claimed 3,000 members. In April 1920, Hitler changed the party's name to the Nationalsozialistische Deutsche Arbeiterpartei, the National Socialist German Workers' Party, abbreviated to Nazi. Following an ill-fated attempt to take control of the government in 1923, known as the Beer Hall Putsch, Hitler and his lieutenants were imprisoned and the Nazi Party languished. Upon his release after only 9 months, Hitler began to direct the Nazi Party into more effective and legal activities, which resulted in the Nazis becoming the largest political party in Germany by July 1932. It was, in fact, wealthy businessmen in Western industrial and banking circles who guaranteed Hitler's success. After Hitler lost a popular election to Hindenburg in 1932, 39 business leaders with familiar names like Krupp, Siemens, Tyson, and Bosch signed a petition using the aged President Paul von Hindenburg to name Hitler Chancellor. In January 1933, through a compromise with German aristocrats, industrialists, and army officers, brokered by banker Baron Kurt Freiherr von Schroeder, Hitler was appointed Chancellor of Germany. The deal to name Hitler Chancellor of Germany was cut at von Schroeder's home on January 4, 1933. On hand were prominent industrialists, at least one director of the giant Deutsche Bank, as well as I.G. Farben's Hermann Schmitz and Dr. Georg von Schnitzler, representing Farben's board of directors. According to author Eustace Mullins, also attending this meeting were John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles of the New York law firm Sullivan & Cromwell, which represented the Schroeder Bank. This claim has been disputed by other researchers. At that time, Germany was a free republic with one of the most educated and cultured populations in the world. The country was at peace and enjoying a blossoming of democratic freedom under a coalition government of the Weimar Republic. Oddly, Hitler went against tradition by choosing not to work out of an office in the German Reichstag, or parliament building, and on February 27, 1933, the Reichstag was gutted by fire. In those slower, gentler times, this act was as great a shock to the German people as the destruction of the World Trade Center towers was to Americans in 2001. Hitler blamed the destruction on communist terrorists. Inside the building, police arrested an incoherent, half-naked, retarded Dutch youth named Marinus van der Lubbe. They said he was carrying a Dutch Communist Party card. After some time in custody, the youth confessed to being the arsonist. However, later investigation found that one person could not have started the mammoth blaze, and that incendiary devices had been carried into the building through a tunnel that led to the offices of Hitler's closest partner, Hermann Göring. Despite misgivings in many quarters about the official explanation of the fire, it was announced that the government is of the opinion that the situation is such that a danger to the state and nation existed and still exists. Law enforcement agencies quickly moved against not only the communists, but also pacifists, liberals, and Democrats. Less than a month later, on March 24, 1933, at Hitler's urging, a panicky German parliament voted 441-94 to pass an enabling act, which became the starting point for Hitler's dictatorship. As a result of the enabling act, the Nazi government required national identity cards, racial profiling, the equivalent of a national homeland security chief, SS Reichsführer Heinrich Himmler, gun confiscation, and later, mass murders and incarcerations in concentration camps. When Germany awoke, wrote British reporter Douglas Reed, a man's home was no longer his castle. He could be seized by private individuals, could claim no protection from the police, could be indefinitely detained without preferment of charge. His property could be seized, his verbal and written communications overheard and perused. He no longer had the right to foregather with his fellow countrymen, and his newspapers might no longer freely express their opinions. Hitler's financiers, and especially Prussian military officers, were becoming alarmed over Hitler's growing power, especially with some 3 million Sturmabteilung, SA, or Storm Detachment brown shirts under the command of Hitler's SA chief, Ernst Röhm, awaiting orders. The army proposed a deal. If the power of the SA was broken, the military would pledge loyalty to Hitler. Hitler agreed, and on June 30, 1934, trumped up charges of plotting a revolution caused Röhm and hundreds of brown shirts to be fatally purged, and the SA quietly faded away. The German military began pledging their allegiance not to their nation, but to Hitler. With the German population firmly under control due to massive propaganda and fear of government retaliation, Hitler was free to launch invasions into former German territories as well as Poland. It is instructive that Hitler did not invade Poland without pretext. A false flag operation was accomplished first. SS men dressed in Polish uniforms fabricated an attack on a German radio station at Gliwice, which allowed Hitler to announce that a counterattack had been launched against Polish soldiers who had invaded German territory. Germany was simply making the world safe for National Socialism. World War II ensued. With the death of the 87-year-old Hindenburg on August 2, 1934, Hitler merged the offices of President and Chancellor and proclaimed himself Commander-in-Chief of the Armed Forces, the absolute leader, Führer, of all Germany. He found a huge and powerful industrial base geared for war production already in place and awaiting his command. It had been put in place at the end of World War I thanks to an influx of Western capital investment. This buildup for European war both before and after 1933 was in great part due to Wall Street financial assistance in the 1920s to create the German cartel system and to technical assistance from well-known American firms to build the German Wehrmacht, noted financial investigator and author Anthony C. Sutton, who added, "The contribution made by American capitalism to German war preparations before 1940 can only be described as phenomenal." For example, in 1934, Germany produced only 300,000 tons of natural petroleum products and synthetic gasoline. In 1944, thanks to the transfer of hydrogenation technology from Standard Oil of New Jersey to IG Farben, Germany produced 6,500,000 tons of oil, 85% of which was synthetic. The intertwining of American capitalism with German corporations began following World War I with two programs, the Dawes Plan, 1924, and the Young Plan, 1928. Both plans, engineered in America, virtually guaranteed success for the fledgling Nazi Party. The Dawes Plan, designed to restructure German war reparations, was named for chairman of the Allied Reparations Committee, Charles G. Dawes, and described by historian Carol Quigley as largely a J.P. Morgan production. This plan used American loans to create and consolidate the German steel and chemical giants Vereinigte Stahlwerke and IG Farben, both major supporters of Hitler. It caused anger and frustration among Germans because it meant foreign control of Germany's finances, a fact constantly pointed out by Hitler in his speeches, and appeared open-ended, as no final reparation amount was ever announced. Its successor, the Young Plan, named for J.P. Morgan agent Owen D. Young, required burdensome monetary payments from Germany. It, too, led to support within Germany for Hitler and his Nazis. Financing the rearmament of Germany in violation of the Versailles Treaty proved as profitable as it was dangerous to European peace. German steel magnate Fritz Thyssen, a major financial contributor to Hitler, stated, "I turned to the National Socialist Party only after I became convinced that the fight against the Young Plan was unavoidable if complete collapse of Germany was to be prevented." Finance between Germany and the Allied nations was controlled by the Bank of International Settlements, BIS, headquartered in Basel, Switzerland. It was the brainchild of Hjalmar Horace Greeley Schacht, president of the Reichsbank. In 1930, he resigned in protest to the Young Plan, but was reappointed by Hitler in 1933, and the financial genius behind Germany's economic revival. Although his father was an American citizen, Hjalmar was born in Germany during his mother's return there and named after the famous American editor and politician. It was Schacht who provided an ongoing link between Hitler and Germany's industrialists. The BIS was administered by a multinational staff, which historian Quigley called the apex of the system of bankers, to secretly exchange information and plan for the coming war. one of the corporate giants created in post-World War I Germany with assistance from American capital, was Internationalgesellschaft Farbenindustrie, AG, better known in its shorthand version as IG Farben. Created in 1926 by combining six existing chemical companies, it was the brainchild of Hermann Schmitz, who became the firm's president. Under his guidance, IG Farben became the largest chemical manufacturing enterprise in the world. It was so powerful during the Nazi regime that the firm became known as a state within a state. Farben had subsidiaries, offices, and representatives in 93 countries, including the United States. Paul Manning, a CBS News correspondent in Europe during World War II, explained Schmitz's connections by pointing out that the Farben chief once held as much stock in Standard Oil of New Jersey as did the Rockefellers. By the time war began in 1939, IG Farben had doubled in size, gaining participation and managerial control over 380 other German companies, as well as more than 500 foreign firms. This growth was made possible by bond sales in America, including one for $30 million offered by National City Bank, a forerunner of today's Citibank. It was IG Farben's patented Zyklon B, a prussic acid poison gas, that was used to kill victims in the shower baths of Auschwitz, Maidenbeck, and Treblinka. Previously, the firm had received a contract to produce carbon monoxide, used to gas the sick and mentally deficient under Germany's euthanasia program. One example of the close business ties between the United States and Nazi Germany was Walter C. Teagle, chairman of Standard Oil of New Jersey, which was owned by Rockefeller's Chase Bank. Teagle also was a director of American IG Chemical Corporation, one of the subsidiaries of IG Farben, which changed its name to General Aniline and Film, GAF, in an effort to distance itself from its German owners. Teagle, through Rockefeller banking and oil interests, made his superiors a handsome profit just prior to the war. Teagle remained in partnership with Farben in the matter of tetraethyl lead, an additive used in aviation gasoline, wrote author Charles Higham. German Luftwaffe chief Hermann Göring's Air Force couldn't fly without it. Only Standard, DuPont, and General Motors had the rights to it. Teagle helped organize a sale of the precious substance to Farben president Schmitz, who, in 1938, traveled to London and borrowed 500 tons from Ethel, the British Standard subsidiary. Next year, Schmitz and his partners returned to London and obtained $15 million worth. The result was that Hitler's Air Force was rendered capable of bombing London, the city that had provided the supplies. Also by supplying Japan with tetraethyl, Teagle helped make it possible for the Japanese to wage World War II. Following negative publicity regarding these tetraethyl transactions in 1938, Teagle resigned from the board of GAF to be replaced by future Secretary of Defense James V. Forrestal. Curiously, it was the same Walter Teagle who helped create the National Recovery Administration, one of President Roosevelt's New Deal agencies designed to regulate American business. This was an odd choice if the captains of American industry were as opposed to socialism as they publicly claimed. By the mid-1930s, with the government, military, and the German cartels now firmly in hand, Hitler knew it was time to strengthen his influence over international bankers and businessmen. Despite his declared intentions to nationalize German businesses and curtail the power of international business and finance, Hitler initially had little trouble getting funds from corporate sponsors who saw his National Socialism as a necessary alternative to worldwide communism. His appeal to the common people offered a chance to win the working class away from communism, noted James Poole, author of Who Financed Hitler? In America, efforts were underway to market Nazism to the public while concurrently practicing economic espionage. Teagle, together with Farben chief Schmitz, hired famed New York publicist Ivy Lee to pass proprietary information on American companies to Germany and to spin news stories so as to gloss over the darker side of Nazism. By the late 1930s, Lee was being paid $25,000 a year for disseminating pro-Nazi propaganda in America. Payments to Lee came from a Farben U.S. subsidiary, American IG, and moved through Lee's company account with Chase Bank and his personal account at New York Trust Company. They were American funds earned in the U.S. and under control of American directors, although used for Nazi propaganda in the United States, stated author Sutton. Another solid conduit for Nazi propaganda and intelligence activities was the Hamburg-America shipping line. Max Warburg, a leader of Deutsche Bank, sat on the board of Hamburg-America steamship line, along with Prescott Bush, father and grandfather of two future U.S. presidents. Max Warburg was the brother of Paul Warburg, America's first chairman of the Federal Reserve System and the man in charge of U.S. finances in World War I. American IG Chemical Corporation was more than just a source of funds. It provided important intelligence to the Nazis throughout the war, as noted by IG Farben director Max Igner, the nephew of Farben's chairman Schmitz. He wrote, "Extensive information which we receive continuously from American IG is indispensable for our observation of American conditions, and is, since the beginning of the war, an important source of information for governmental, economic, and military offices." The full story of IG Farben and its worldwide activities before World War II can never be known, noted author Sutton, as key German records were destroyed in 1945 in anticipation of Allied victory. The banking industry, including foreign financial houses, provided Hitler and his Nazis with the funds to both consolidate and spread their National Socialist doctrine. Throughout World War II, the Bank of Baron von Schroeder acted as financial agents for Germany in both Britain and the United States. Anthony C. Sutton described how John Foster Dulles handled Schroeder bank loans in the USA. In fact, Dulles, in addition to providing legal services to a joint Rockefeller-Schroeder investment firm, the Schroeder-Rockefeller Company, also sat on the board of directors of General Aniline and Film, GAF, from 1927 to 1934. GAF, as it was known during the war, remained a subsidiary of IG Farben. Schroeder, the powerful head of the J.H. Stein & Company banking house of Cologne, had long provided financial support to the Nazis in hopes they would counteract the spread of communism. Hitler had given his word to von Schroeder that National Socialism would engage in no foolish economic experiments. In other words, he would not attack banking practices except in rhetoric. This closeness between Hitler and the banking industry reached back to the earliest days of the Nazi Party. On New Year's Day, 1924, the financial fate of Germany was settled in London at a meeting between Hjalmar Schacht, the new Reich Commissioner for National Currency, and Montague Norman, Governor of the Bank of England, noted author John Toland. Schacht, who had already abolished emergency money, began with a frank disclosure of Germany's desperate financial situation. He then proposed to open a German credit bank second to the Reichsbank, but one that would issue notes in pound sterling. Schacht asked Norman to provide half the capital for this new bank. Within 48 hours, Norman not only formally approved the loan at the exceptionally low interest of a flat 5%, but convinced a group of London bankers to accept bills far exceeding the loan, Toland wrote. A year after the meeting at Schroeder's home that launched Hitler into power, Nazi official and ideologist Alfred Rosenberg met with Schroeder Bank of London managing director T. C. Tjarks, who also was a director of the Bank of England. Montague Norman, governor of the Bank of England in early 1934, informed a select group of City of London financiers that Hitler's regime was a system with a good future. With no opposition, it was decided to provide covert financial help to Hitler until Norman could persuade the British government to abandon its pro-French policy to one more favorable to Germany. Thus, a curious relationship developed between these powerful banks of two supposedly belligerent nations, which continued throughout the war. Of course, it only appears curious to those who do not understand the economic cooperation among the world's ruling elite. In December 1938, Schacht came to England as a guest at Montague Norman's home. The visit was declared to be purely personal. 1 month later, the hospitality was returned when Norman stopped over in Berlin for a visit with Schacht on his way to Switzerland. Although there was no public announcement as to what the two men discussed, it was rumored that they were attempting to create a common policy of settling Germany's foreign debts and expanding its markets. There were also rumors that Britain's bankers might extend to Germany some $375 million in export credits. The importance of such financial cooperation was explained by Sutton. In the 1920s and 1930s, the New York Federal Reserve System, the Bank of England, the Reichsbank in Germany, and the Banque de France also more or less influenced the political apparatus of their respective countries indirectly through control of the money supply and creation of the monetary environment. More direct influence was realized by supplying political funds to, or withdrawing support from, politicians and political parties. Funds for this financial control were channeled through the Bank of International Settlements that, according to the bank's charter and with the agreement of the respective governments, was immune from seizure, closure, or censure, even if its owners were at war. These owners included the Morgan-affiliated First National Bank of New York, among whose directors were Harold S. Vanderbilt and Wendell Willkie, the Bank of England, the Reichsbank, the Bank of Italy, the Bank of France, and other central banks. The bank, BIS, soon turned out to be a money funnel for American and British funds to flow into Hitler's coffers and to help Hitler build up his war machine, wrote Higham. By the start of World War II, the BIS was under Nazi control with the bank's directors, including Schmitz, Schroeder, Dr. Walter Frank, and Emil Puhl of the Reichsbank. In 1939, when the Nazis moved into Czechoslovakia, officials of the Czech National Bank removed $48 million in gold reserves to the Bank of England for safekeeping. Under pressure from the Nazis, Bank of England Governor Montague Norman unhesitatingly agreed to move the gold to Switzerland, where it went into Nazi accounts to purchase essential war materials for Germany. Despite the obvious rearmament of Germany in the late 1930s, the Nazis continued to find support in Britain, even within the Rothschild-dominated Bank of England. This pro-Nazi proclivity by Bank of England officials will assume even more relevance in the events described in the next section. Illustrating further interconnecting business associations of this time was International Telephone and Telegraph, ITT, German chairman Gerhard Westrick, a close associate of John Foster Dulles, who was a partner to Dr. Heinrich Albert, head of Ford Motor Company in Germany until 1945. Two ITT directors were German banker Schroeder and Walter Schellenberg, head of counterintelligence for the Nazi Gestapo, the Nazi Geheime Staatspolizei, or Secret State Police. America's International Telephone and Telegraph Corporation sold Germany communication and war material, including as many as 50,000 artillery fuses per month, more than 3 years after Pearl Harbor. The more interconnecting business ties between America and the Nazis can be seen by studying the Rockefeller-owned Chase National Bank, now J.P. Morgan Chase Bank, the largest corporate bank in the United States. Charles Higham explained how the Rockefellers owned Standard Oil of New Jersey, the German accounts of which were siphoned through their own bank, the Chase, as well as through the independent National City Bank of New York, NCB, which also handled Standard, Sterling Products, General Aniline and Film, part of the IG Farben combine, Swedish Enskilde Bank, SKF, and ITT, whose chief, Sostenis Ben, was a director of NCB. Two executives of Standard Oil's German subsidiary were Karl Lindemann and Emil Helfferich, prominent figures in Himmler's circle of friends of the Gestapo, its chief financiers, and close friends and colleagues of BIS's Baron von Schroeder. Further banking connections, noted by author William Bramley, involved German banker Max Warburg and his brother Paul Warburg, who had been instrumental in establishing the Federal Reserve System in the United States. Both were directors of I.G. Farben. H.A. Metz of I.G. Farben was a director of the Warburg Bank of Manhattan, which later became part of the Rockefeller Chase Manhattan Bank. Standard Oil of New Jersey had been a cartel partner with I.G. Farben prior to the war. One American I.G. Farben director was C.E. Mitchell, who was also director of the Federal Reserve Bank of New York and of Warburg's National City Bank. I.G. Farben president Hermann Schmitz served on the boards of Deutsche Bank and the Bank for International Settlements. In 1929, Schmitz was voted president of the board of National City Bank, now Citibank. In the 1930s, many people in both Britain and America were in agreement with Nazi ideology. Automobile maker Henry Ford became a guiding light to Hitler, especially in the realm of anti-Semitism. In 1920, Ford published an anti-Jewish book titled The International Jew. As Hitler worked on his book, Mein Kampf, in 1924, he copied liberally from Ford's writing and even referred to Ford as one great man. Ford became an admirer of Hitler, provided funds for the Nazis, and in 1938 became the first American to receive the highest honor possible for a non-German, the Grand Cross of the Supreme Order of the German Eagle. Ford's son, Edsel, sat on the board of American I.G. Farben and GAF. In July 1940, at a meeting in Dearborn, Michigan between ITT's Westrick and the Fords, it was decided that rather than build aircraft engines for beleaguered Britain, the Ford Company would build 5-ton military trucks for Germany, the backbone of German army transportation. And the Fords were not alone in providing Nazi Germany with the means to wage war. Bradford Snell told the Washington Post in 1998 that Nazi armaments minister Albert Speer once told him that Hitler would never have considered invading Poland without the synthetic fuel technology provided by General Motors. One future American corporate giant provided the Nazis with the means of registering, correlating, and assigning shipment schedules to the millions of Jews and others that were rounded up and sent to their deaths in concentration camps. According to author Edwin Black, Hitler's desire to tabulate, then eliminate these people was greatly enhanced and energized by the ingenuity and craving for profit of a single American company and its legendary autocratic chairman. That company was International Business Machines, IBM, and its chairman was Thomas J. Watson. Using recently discovered Nazi documents and the testimony of former Polish workers, Black found that IBM technology was passed not only through the company's German subsidiary, Deutsche Hollerith Maschinen Gesellschaft, DHOMAG, but to a great extent through a subsidiary in Poland, Watson Business Machines in Warsaw, which reported directly to the IBM New York headquarters. Watson kept in close contact with his German subordinates, traveling to Berlin at least twice a year from 1933 to 1939. Watson never sold IBM machines to the Nazis. They were all merely leased. This meant that all machines were dependent on IBM punch cards, parts, and servicing. Interestingly, IBM punch cards of that time were not standardized. Each batch sent to Nazi Germany was custom designed by IBM engineers. Railroad cars, which would take 2 weeks to locate and route, could be swiftly dispatched in just 48 hours by means of a vast network of punch card machines. Indeed, IBM services coursed through the entire German infrastructure in Europe, noted Black. After America's entry into the war, Nazi Hermann Fellinger was appointed as German enemy property custodian. Fellinger maintained Watson Business Machines, keeping the original staff and ensuring continued profits for IBM. This subsidiary continued to send royalties and reports to the New York home offices through IBM's Geneva office. Watson, a well-connected Freemason, proclaimed world peace through world trade in 1937, while in Berlin to be named president of the International Chamber of Commerce. In that same year, President Franklin D. Roosevelt named Watson U.S. Commissioner General to the International Exposition in Paris, and Hitler created a special medal for Watson, called the Merit Cross of the German Eagle with Star, to honor foreign nationals who made themselves deserving of the German Reich. It ranked second in prestige only to Hitler's German Grand Cross, noted Edwin Black. Since the war, IBM has obstructed or refused to cooperate with virtually every major independent author writing about its history, according to numerous published introductions, prefaces, and acknowledgments, he added. Along with aviation hero Charles Lindbergh and newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst, another American supporter of Hitler was Joseph P. Kennedy, father of the future president. Kennedy was appointed U.S. ambassador to Britain in 1939, but was recalled in November 1940 for voicing his sympathies for Hitler. Roosevelt had been advised by FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover that Joseph P. Kennedy, the former ambassador to England, and Ben Smith, the Wall Street operator, sometime in the past had a meeting with Nazi Luftwaffe chief Hermann Göring in Vichy, France, and that thereafter, Kennedy and Smith had donated a considerable amount of money to the German cause. They are both described as being very anti-British and pro-German. One important example of a pre-war effort to install a fascist dictatorship within the United States is the attempted overthrow of Roosevelt early in his presidency. Only a year after Hitler came to power in Germany, many wealthy Americans looked with favor on a fascist system to counteract international communism. Many were disgusted with President Roosevelt's social policies and felt he was secretly a communist. Irénée Dupont and General Motors President William S. Knudsen in early 1934 planned to finance a coup d'état that would overthrow the president with the aid of a $3 million funded army of terrorists, modeled on the fascist movement in Paris known as the Croix de Feu. The undoing of this scheme was retired Marine Corps Major General Smedley Butler, the most decorated Marine in U.S. history, who was approached by the plotters and urged to head the new military government. Butler, who had openly attacked Roosevelt's New Deal programs, however, proved to be a loyal citizen and immediately informed Roosevelt of the treasonous conspiracy. Roosevelt knew that if he were to arrest the leaders of the houses of Morgan and DuPont, it would create an unthinkable national crisis in the midst of a depression and perhaps another Wall Street crash. Not for the first or last time in his career, he was aware that there were powers greater than he in the United States, noted Higham. Roosevelt decided to leak the story to the press, which generally discounted it as a ridiculous rumor. Nevertheless, some of the primary plotters skipped the country until the Führer died down. But the story did prompt Congress to appoint a special committee to look into the matter. Yielding to the powerful interests involved, the committee dragged its feet for 4 years before finally publishing a report marked for restricted circulation. Although downplaying the significance of this attempted coup, the committee's report did state that certain persons made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country, and that the committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler. Some researchers have speculated that this move against Roosevelt was merely a ploy orchestrated by the same elite families that put him into power. It was a scheme to paint FDR as an opponent of Wall Street and gain public support for his policies. If this plot was legitimate, it was the last overt move against an American president by powerful business interests until 1963. Ploy or not, this incident provides not only an example of hidden U.S. history, but also the lengths to which powerful persons will go to subvert the principles of the United States. Even at the time, some astute Americans could clearly see the connections between powerful national business leaders and Nazi Germany. U.S. Ambassador to Germany William E. Dodd told reporters upon his arrival back home in 1937 A clique of U.S. industrialists is hell-bent to bring a fascist state to supplant our democratic government and is working closely with the fascist regime in Germany and Italy. I have had plenty of opportunity in my post in Berlin to witness how close some of our American ruling families are to the Nazi regime. It was not just the ruling families that looked favorably on National Socialism and a fascist government. Prior to World War II, right-wing demagogues like Father Charles Coughlin and Gerald K. Smith, an ordained minister, drew thousands of supporters from Christian American workers into their America First and Union Party with their message of nationalism and fears of a Jewish conspiracy. Smith's planned religious theme park in the 1960s was never completed, but his Christ of the Ozarks draws tourists to Eureka Springs, Arkansas to this day. Prior to the war, no one paid serious attention to warnings against the spread of fascism, just as few people seem willing to consider the possibility of a fascist takeover of the USA today. A successful political movement requires money. Lots of it. There is no question that Hitler's rise to power rested heavily on the support of the major German banks, Schroeder's Cologne banking firm, the Deutsche Bank, Deutsche Kreditgesellschaft, and the huge insurance firm Allianz, all with many interconnecting ties to foreign banks and companies. There were also close ties to prominent U.S. banks. Haim described how, in 1936, the J. Henry Schroeder Bank of New York had entered into a partnership with the Rockefellers. Named Schroeder, Rockefeller & Company, investment bankers, the firm became what Time magazine called the economic booster of the Rome-Berlin Axis. Avery Rockefeller owned 42% of Schroeder, Haim reported. Their lawyers were John Foster Dulles and Alan Dulles of Sullivan & Cromwell. Alan Dulles, later of the Office of Strategic Services, was on the board of Schroeder. One Deutsche Bank executive outlined a few of the bank's wartime loans, 150 million Reichsmarks to the aircraft industry, 22 million to Bavarian Motor Works, BMW, 10 million to Daimler-Benz, Mercedes, in 1943 alone. Similar amounts were loaned again in 1944. But all the tightest business connections came to naught, for by 1941, the international order had turned against Hitler. Germany's blitzkrieg had shocked the ruling elite, as first Poland, then the rest of Europe, came under Nazi control. Britain was helpless to stop Hitler, who was already making preparations for a preemptive attack on the Soviet Union. In short, Hitler was getting out of hand.